everybody. This is Chris.
And Kathy.
We wanted to take a minute to thank you all for tuning in. We appreciate every listener and are grateful for this platform.
Please help us share our vision by subscribing to our show through your favorite streaming app. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at Petability Podcast.
Check out our ever-growing list of affiliates and sponsors. Simply go to the show notes for information and links.
And be sure to use our promo code PETPOD22, that's PETPOD22, on checkout to receive your discount from our affiliates. And now here's a word from our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Alon Landa, CEO of MedcoVet, and I'm a proud sponsor of Petability. We decided to partner with Chris and Kathy because, like them, we want to empower all pet owners who are trying to do the most for their pets. At MedcoVet, we specialize in advanced home laser therapy for pets. Laser therapy is a safe and effective treatment for common conditions like arthritis and wounds, and it relieves pain for most conditions caused by inflammation. With MedcoVet, pet owners can perform this treatment at home while receiving support from experienced clinicians. If you think your pet would benefit from healing at home, visit MedcoVet.com, and one of our clinical experts will work with you to determine if home laser therapy is the right fit for you and your pet. Tell them Petability sent you.
Welcome to Petability. I'm your host, Kathy Simons.
And I'm your host, Chris Cranston. Our podcast provides interviews and information to help your pets live their best lives. Good afternoon, Kathy. What's up today?
Good afternoon, Chris. Oh my gosh, I just had a whole thing happen like 2 minutes before we came on the air. I saw a loose dog running down my street. and I chased it. And thankfully reunited it with its owner. So I feel like there'll probably be some award ceremony and parade.
Yes.
For me. But yes, so if I sound a little frazzled, it's because I just came inside from the rain, you know, saving this dog who was running down the street. So
you got some adrenaline pumping there.
Right. That was my big moment. Yeah. Big moment.
You've done a good deed, but I want to just caution any of our children listeners out there. Do not chase dogs you do not know.
Yeah. And I will reframe that. I didn't actually chase the dog. I went out and called the dog and the dog came to me.
Oh, there you go.
I'll reframe that. And then he followed me home. I just said, come on. We went together. So in any case, that's why I'm got a little bit more adrenaline than usual. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm ready for the show.
Yeah.
I mean, a great topic today.
Yeah. Let's carry that into our show of the day, which is focusing on veterinary hospice. So right. Hospice for our pets. And our wonderful guest today is Dr. Becky Schoenberg, who is a graduate of the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine. And while there, she spent 3 years volunteering on the Pet Loss Support Hotline, which until I was preparing for this interview, I didn't even know such a thing existed. But there are There are resources out there.
Yeah.
And she has those listed on her website. So she also pursued an independent study in the human animal bond and grief support. Upon graduating, she returned to her home of Massachusetts and began practicing in small animal medicine. That was in 2001. And it was a great treat for me because she actually spent some time with me at Flow Dog years ago.
Nice.
And yeah, I thought that was so amazing.
Awesome.
Because here, you know, was this veterinarian that was coming into my very small rehab specific practice to learn more about what physical rehabilitation for our pets look like and, you know, maybe some pain control techniques and things like that that we were using as physical rehabilitationists. So I always admired that.
Yeah.
And over time, you know, she began to understand the crucial role that our animal companions play in people's lives and the importance of caring for those companions as they age and the importance of the veterinarian and helping those pets and people through challenging transitions. And so, you know, we're all coming, you know, from that same place. So again, makes Dr. Becky Schoenberg such a perfect guest for our show.
Right.
So in 2015, she created a business called Autumn Care and Crossings.
I'm thinking back to my earlier part of my career, you know, when I started as a technician, and this was quite some time ago, it's probably, you know, 25 plus years, you would not have heard the word hospice in those days. So it's so great to see how veterinary medicine is changing to really meet the needs of our clients and patients.
You know, we've seen so many things. I'm sure all of us have things growing, you know, in the realm of veterinary medicine as the needs, wants, and desires of, you know, the pet parents really right. are coming, you know, to the forefront. A lot of this is driven by the consumer, you know, and right. so just a few more little things about Dr. Schoenberg. So she comes well credentialed. She's a member of the American Veterinary Medical Association, the Massachusetts Veterinary Medical Association, the International Association of Animal Hospice and Palliative Care, and the International Veterinary Academy of Pain Management. And, you know, maybe as we get into this a little bit, I was also stunned to learn that there is now a certification in hospice and palliative care
wow.
for veterinarians. And our guest was part of the first graduating class, if you will, and one of fewer than 60 other veterinarians worldwide to receive this certification.
Wow.
So that's just
amazing.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yep. And just one last thing. I also, before the show ends, I want her to tell us about her cranky ball python that she has at home. Because that needs to be talked about for sure.
So, yeah, for sure.
Without further ado, welcome Dr. Becky Schoenberg.
Welcome, Dr. Schoenberg.
It is an honor to be here. Thank you for inviting me to be part of this. I've been looking forward to it.
I'm going to jump right in, Chris, if that's all right with you, because I think that it would be great if Dr. Schoenberg could talk about what is hospice. Like I said before, when I started as a technician, this is the mid-80s, you would not have heard the term hospice for animal care, for your patient, for your pet. So I'd want to know what the definition of hospice is, and I want to know, what does hospice look like for a pet?
So animal hospice is actually a relatively new field. Just like you were saying, it's only had a name for maybe 10 or 15 years. We've only been able to put a name to it, and it's only been a recognized field with its own certification for 5 years or less. So it is a very new phenomenon in veterinary medicine. But in short, hospice is a change in focus. It's as much a philosophy as a class of medicine. And what it is changing the primary goal of our care away from aggressively seeking a cure at any cost mm-hmm. and towards focusing on the quality of life, comfort, and well-being of both the animal patient and their caregivers.
And when you say cost, you're not talking monetary cost. You're talking the cost to the animal, like the cost benefit and things like that too, right?
Yes, exactly. At a lot of times, general Western medicine, the goal of treatment is to cure. And there are times in medicine where it is either no longer possible or doing so would be more traumatic and stressful to the patient and their family. And at that point, hospice care steps in to say, you know, we're not necessarily going to prioritize longevity. We're not going to prioritize the time you have here. We're going to prioritize the quality of that time.
I like how you include the pet parent in that statement, that treatment could be traumatizing for the patient, but it could also be traumatizing for the client. And that's also sort of a new line of thinking for us in veterinary medicine, right? What does it look like for the owners? Are they experiencing caretaker fatigue? What is this going to do, or how is this going to affect their family and the dynamics within their family and their pet?
Absolutely. The burden of care is one of the biggest things that we focus on in hospice, both, as you mentioned before, the cost financially, but also the cost in time, the cost in impact on the human-animal bond if you're constantly taking your pet to a place that is stressful to them or having to give them medicine in a way that makes them resent you. Not to mention the fact that facing a loss like this is difficult and complicated and can bring up all sorts of other emotions from previous losses as well.
So in looking at your website, and we'll give our listeners, you know, that information at the end. But again, it's Autumn Care and Crossings. You have three branches of service, and I think you've already kind of alluded to this in defining hospice. So, you know, your pet populations and the services that kind of intertwine and go together, you're working with a geriatric population, you're working with pain management, you're doing hospice, palliative care, and then, of course, it inevitably may lead to end-of-life care and ultimately euthanasia. So, you know, it sounds like, you know, you've got that whole spectrum covered. I also noticed that, you know, hospice and palliative care, I'm not sure if I know the difference between those two. Can you differentiate what palliative care is versus hospice?
Absolutely. So, like I said, hospice is a philosophy and an approach to medicine. Palliative care is kind of how we implement that. Palliative care is any care that is focused on improving comfort and quality of life, which is the primary drive of hospice. The main distinction is that palliative care can be implemented in any treatment plan. It doesn't have to be caring for a terminally ill patient. And that's one area where veterinary medicine has actually a benefit over human medicine, because we're less hampered by terms and definitions and restrictions. So one of the things that I really learned to appreciate when I started practicing was that I can join a pet's care team and start implementing palliative care techniques. So ways to keep them comfortable, ways to support them, ways to make things easier for their family while they're still seeking curative care through, say, an oncologist or an orthopedic surgeon or through their general practitioner.
So can you give us or give the audience a few examples of what might be involved in palliative care? Are we talking about pain management? Are we talking about, you know, fluid therapy? What would be considered palliative?
Both of those are good examples. Other things that can be involved in palliative care, a lot of what I do is nutrition and managing nausea, whether that's a result of medication side effects, treatment impacts, or from the pet's condition itself. Environmental support, so looking around their home and saying, how can we make it easier for the pet to be comfortable and to move around their space? Palliative care can also be finding ways to help support their mobility in addition to pain management. It can be finding ways to make it easier to treat them. So getting medicine compounded in a form that's easier to administer, or finding support techniques, whether that means having a vet tech or a skilled caregiver come into the home and help with treatment, or even to just give the family a little bit of a breather from being a 24/7 caregiver.
Right. And there's so much crossover here. As you're talking, I'm thinking there's so much that Chris and I could do for patients who are receiving palliative care or end of life treatment, just coming in and talking about how to modify their home, how to, you know, get their dog traction, how to raise the bowls, things that we could do to make the dog or cat more comfortable with simple modifications of their living area.
Chris was one of my first mentors on this subject, That is absolutely true.
It's Chris's idea, yeah.
And yep. I'm still preaching the same stuff. So
yeah,
you know, and also things like wagons to get them outside and enjoy life, and you know, again, speaking to that quality of life, or a sling or harness to help them, you know, negotiate the stairs, and you know, one thing I was thinking of, because like you said, Dr. Becky, that it's not just, you know, the terminally ill or the end of life that we're addressing this. It can be at any stage. And so one thing I was thinking of was, you know, all these dogs that have cruciate injuries. And certainly, you know, not everybody can afford a surgery of thousands of dollars, or maybe that pet has comorbidities that wouldn't make it a candidate for surgery. So I would think that the things that we would do to support that animal, you know, a brace to make it more comfortable, again, a sling or a harness, proper pain management in terms of, you know, massage, laser, medications, would that be considered palliative care? Because you're not curing anything. You're not necessarily fixing the problem, but you're supporting that pet and making them as comfortable and functional as possible.
Absolutely. And in fact, patients with multiple comorbidities are one area that really benefits from in-home palliative care. When I talk about working with geriatrics, that's a lot of what I do, trying to figure out how to help manage the delicate balance in a patient where either treating one condition may worsen another, or the meds needed to treat their two different conditions are not mutually compatible, or just the act of managing so many different things can become confusing and overwhelming for the caregivers. That's a place where hospice and palliative care really excels. Just because we can sit down, take the time to explain everything thoroughly, support people through their decision-making process, and empower them to figure out where their priorities are and what is going to have the most impact on their pet's comfort and happiness. It's also situations where we know that, for instance, adding in a particular treatment may shorten a pet's lifespan, but make the time they have better. So say, you know, we have two conditions, both of them are terminal. Which one can we treat to make them most comfortable? Which one is going to have the greater impact on their quality of life? Or conversely, we can add in this medicine. It may make problem number one a little worse, but it's going to make problem number two a lot better. Right. And it's that weighing and measuring of the impacts that if we're focusing on an aggressive cure, the rules would say treat everything, don't add in anything that might shorten their lifespan. Instead, we're saying we know they're going to pass. We understand that this may make it a little sooner, but they're going to feel a lot better in the meantime.
It happens all the time when you see animals that have two a comorbidity like heart disease and kidney disease. And then when you're in end stage and you have to sort of make that decision, which one are we going to treat that's going to make this pet feel the best in that time frame that they have? And I think owners really appreciate that you can go over this with them, because I have some clients who are giving their pets a very high level of care. And these dogs are most often in the end stages of their lives. And it can be so overwhelming, and it's 24/7. So to have somebody who can go over this with you and talk about goals and quality of life and markers. Is your dog still experiencing joy? Is your dog still eating? Is your dog mobile? Things like that.
Exactly. And there's also just a lot of explaining and translating. Oftentimes when people are at an appointment and they get bad news or a bad diagnosis, they're focused enough on that that they don't have the spare processing capacity to take in a lot of details. And oftentimes in a general practice, an appointment, in a 20-minute or a half-hour appointment, the doctor doesn't have a lot of time to go into the nitty-gritty details of what is going on in their pet's body. So a lot of times what I do is just sitting down and explaining to people, for instance, you talked about heart disease, the difference between heart disease and heart failure, or why the heart and the kidneys are such enemies when it comes to treatment. Yeah. And what exactly is going on in the body so the owners feel like they have a better grounding in their pet's condition.
Dr. Schoenberg, I'm actually really interested. I know I'm going off the path here, but I'm really interested in why you chose hospice and palliative care. What took you in that direction?
So as Chris said earlier, when I started in vet school, the best advice I ever got from my mentor was to volunteer on the pet loss hotline. Mm-hmm. And the time that I spent there was incredibly powerful. And it really brought home to me that veterinary medicine is not just about the animals, but it's about both the caregivers and the bond that they have with their pet as well, and how much we as doctors can do to help support that. And I had been looking for a way to put this into my practice after I graduated, and I kept running into situations where pets had kind of fallen through the cracks and where people hadn't been supported and had been kind of let down in care, where people would be given a terminal diagnosis for their pet and told, "We're so sorry, this is heartbreaking, call us when you're ready to euthanize."
Right.
And realizing there was a big space in between, here's the diagnosis and euthanasia, that they weren't being helped through. And when I heard that there was a group forming on the International Association of Animal Hospice and Palliative Care, it was like the last piece in the jigsaw puzzle of my career. It was, that was what I had been, someone put a name on what I had been looking to do. And then it just took me a couple of years to get up the courage to actually do it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did. It's absolutely needed in veterinary medicine. And how much of your time would you say is spent sort of counseling the pet owner?
My time taking care of a patient is about 50-50 between the animals and the humans. And I do think of the people, the caregivers, as part of the treatment unit. They are as important as the pet. The only caveat I have is that I am not a therapist or a licensed mental health professional. Mm. So while I can give support and guidance and counseling, I also do make sure to give information like that to all of my clients as well, to let them know that it's not just okay, but important to reach out to grief counselors, to a therapist, whether it's for themselves or to help find family consensus, because there's a limit to how much I do. I am an animal expert. I am a people dabbler.
And I think that oftentimes people feel sort of lonely in that grief for their pet, because it's not widely accepted by maybe their friends or their family that they have this overwhelming emotion for just a dog or just a cat. And so I think it's really important. And I think you're absolutely right that people reach out to someone when they're experiencing that. And we did a show not that long ago with licensed mental health care counselor, Lori Levine. And we talked a lot about grief and how she can help people with their grief. So if you have an opportunity, you should go back and listen to that show as well.
And I think when we talk about grief, it's not just after the pet has passed. I mean,
right.
You know, oftentimes when it's a protracted illness or decline, you know, we start grieving what that animal used to be in terms of, you know, the loss, like they can't, you know, go out and chase the ball anymore. They're now anxious in the car, so they can't go on car rides. So we start grieving all of those little things that, you know, made the time with our pet so special long before they actually pass.
Absolutely. Anticipatory grief is a big concern, whether it is part of aging, and as you say, grieving the loss of our running buddy and the bright, playful, mischievous pet being that used to share our lives, or the anticipatory grief of knowing that your pet has a terminal diagnosis and kind of having that, waiting for that other shoe to drop and not knowing when it's going to drop or how it's going to look when it happens and what to expect. And so that's why I make a a big point of saying, you know, reach out for support, whether it's a mental health professional, whether it's a community of other people dealing with a similar diagnosis, whether it's your neighbors and your family. And why I make a big effort to be an active part of the treatment. One of the differences in hospice care is that I see my patients a lot more frequently and I talk to their caregivers a lot more frequently, both to make sure that I can notice any early changes and intervene before things get worse, but also to make sure that they know that they have a doctor on their team, on their side, engaged and concerned.
Your practice is a mobile one. Can you tell us a little bit why you chose to have a mobile practice? What are the unique advantages or benefits of that?
Absolutely. I think that it's very important for hospice care to be mobile because there's so much that we can learn both by seeing the pet's environment and by observing the pet when they're relaxed and in their home state. When an animal goes into the doctor's office, even if it's one of those goofy, happy labs who loves going in because they get treats and cheese and pittance, they're still going to be acting differently than they do when they're at home. So seeing them in their home space lets me learn a lot more about what they're like when they're at rest. It also gives me a chance to see their environment so that I can make recommendations for modification, whether that's things like you said, elevating the food bowls, changing the flooring to give extra traction for cats. You know, maybe we can move their litter box or get some pet stairs to help them get to and from the furniture. It gives me an idea of what their surroundings are like, what stresses they experience, where they like to go to rest or relax. It also makes it a lot easier for the family and for the pet because there is no stressy car ride. There is no time spent waiting in a lobby with other people who have happy, healthy puppies and kittens saying, oh, what are you here for?
Yeah.
And it means that I have no other distractions during that visit. I can be fully present there for that family.
And I think one of the things that, you know, from my side of the table as a veterinary technician versus the owner is, I don't know that people understand that in able to do hospice or palliative care or euthanasia, you need to make an emotional connection with the patient and with the client. And so coming to their house and not being distracted and just focusing on them and what their lives look like is so important.
Exactly. And I do wind up a little bit in love with every pet that I take care of.
Me too. Same.
You know, hearing you say this, Dr. Becky, I started out in small animal rehabilitation as a mobile practice. And then I did a number of things in between, including owning my own business, as you know. And then now I'm back to exclusively doing a mobile practice. So I've gone full circle, and all of the things that you described and, you know, the reasons why, you know, definitely resonate with me. You know, it's exactly the same. So wonderful. So tell us a little bit, you know, what would you say is the hardest part of your job? And then conversely, what's the most gratifying part of your practice and what you do?
Would it be cheating to say that Boston traffic is the worst part?
That is
yes,
legit.
That's totally legit.
Aside from driving through Boston traffic at rush hour,
yes,
the worst part is knowing that no matter how hard I work and no matter how much I try and no matter how much my caregivers and pet parents put into this, I'm going to lose every patient.
Yeah.
And that is difficult. I won't deny it, because especially when sometimes you get an early win and you're able to help them and you can get them eating or you can get them walking again, it's a victory and everybody celebrates, but you know that it's going to progress again and it's not forever. And you start thinking, maybe I can pull out one more miracle, just one more miracle.
So do you take your own advice? Do you take your own advice and, you know, take care of your mental health and emotions as well? I mean, not to be nosy, but I would think that's important, you know, in terms of caregiver compassion fatigue stuff.
It really is. And I'm lucky to have a really amazing support structure. Awesome. And I wouldn't be able to do this without it. And the other thing that makes it worthwhile is you can ask what the best parts are. And I would say literally everything else. I love what I do. I love the fact that I can make a difference for in a time when people need help. I love knowing that people who would otherwise be lost and pets that would otherwise be struggling are feeling better, even for a day or a week or a month, because I was able to step in and help. And I also, as hard as it sounds, I love it when 6 months later or a year later, a family sends me a picture of their new puppy or their new kitten.
Right.
And I know that they've healed and grieved and moved on to a point where they can welcome that love back into their life again. And that is like a little sunrise.
It really is. You mentioned earlier that you work a lot with the animals team. Mm-hmm. And are you the person who coordinates everything for the pet and the family? Are you communicating with the primary care vet? How are you organizing everybody?
So the concept of the hospice team is something that is variable depending on what each patient needs. So sometimes the team is me and their primary caregiver and their veterinary specialists. Sometimes it's the mental health caregivers or pet sitters or dog walkers that are coming in and out. Sometimes it's the compounding pharmacy. I feel like having a pharmacy on my team is one of the most important things that I can have as a hospice practitioner. But as for coordinating that care, while I do communicate directly with their GP and the specialists they work with, I tend to act as more of a data aggregation center, for lack of a better way to phrase it. I have all of that information and I have put it down in writing and I organize it for the caregivers, but I do also leave it to them to do a lot of the communication with their specialists as well, because they know what they're going to need, and the fewer obstacles I can put to them getting help, the better.
Do people tend to reach out to you, you know, I don't want to sound grim, but like in time? Or have you found that, you know, they're, because hospice is so relatively new and such, that when it becomes a desperate or dire situation and pet owners start asking around, and then that, you know, they look online, or, you know, they're communicating with friends, families, you know, their primary vet, neighbors. And then they're like, oh, there's, you know, Dr. Becky, I've heard wonderful things about her, but it tends to be maybe too late.
So I do wish that more people would reach out to me earlier in the process. And that is there are a combination of factors contributing to that. Veterinary hospice is, like we keep saying, a new field and not widely known. And when people do hear about it, they're colored by their perceptions of human hospice, where they have this mental image of someone who's already tried everything and is close to passing. So I get a lot of, oh, it's not time yet. He's not in hospice yet. He still can walk. He still can eat. And if there's one thing that I would like people to know, is that the earlier you reach out to a hospice provider, the more we can help you. And luckily, as word gets out, as people find out that this is an option, more and more people are reaching out to me and to other hospice caregivers earlier in the course of their pet's illness. And that's great, because there's more then that we can do to help them, to support them, and to keep their pet as comfortable as possible for as long as possible.
That makes sense. And then that kind of brings me to, you know, circling back, your services for, you know, our geriatric friends and the pain management piece. Can you describe, you know, maybe what you do there, some of the common diagnoses that you work with where you can have a tremendous impact early on?
Absolutely. Pain management is one of my passions and one of my favorite areas of practice because there is so much that we can do. And there are, our options are expanding almost daily. We're learning more and more ways to intervene. We're getting more and more treatment options. And it's something that, again, a lot of general practitioners just don't have the time for. They're overwhelmed, they're overburdened. And I have the ability to take an hour to sit there and watch the dog sit down, stand up, move around their house. And there are a lot of different ways to help support. Sometimes that's prescription medication. Sometimes that's supplements. Sometimes it's mobility assistance devices like toe grips and harnesses and putting down extra traction in the house. And sometimes it is counseling owners about how to recognize signs of pain, how to know that things are progressing, because so many times I see things dismissed as, oh, he's just old.
Yep.
And explaining to people that, yes, your dog is old, and no, they can't go up the stairs anymore, but no, those two are not, it's their age is not keeping them from going up the stairs. They're actually in pain.
We say age is not a disease.
We always say,
yep.
We always say that age is not a disease.
And you have laser in your practice too, right? Cold laser, therapeutic laser, photobiomodulation.
I do.
Yeah.
I love laser for my older patients for a lot of different reasons. One of the biggest is that it is non-pharmaceutical, and therefore in these old pets that are on so many other medications, we can use it safely. We know that it's not going to interact with any of the medications they're on. We know it's not going to interact with any of their other diseases. It's not going to make their heart disease or their kidneys or their cognitive dysfunction worse. So it's a very safe tool that I can add on without adding any increased risk, without adding any increased side effects, and without adding any burden to the family. All they have to do is sit there and chit chat with me while I'm lasering their dog.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or cat.
Or cats.
But this does raise, both Kathy and I work with Medco Vet, who does have a laser called the Luma that is used by pet owners in their home. And we did interview Alone Landa, the CEO of Medco Vet, about the Luma. And, it's we're definitely believers in laser therapy, photobiomodulation. And so, again, you're one of our people. We're all on the same page. And, love the fact that you use the laser, and encourage our listeners to go to that podcast as well and just learn all the benefits that this modality can provide for your pet.
It makes me think of all the other adjuncts that could possibly be added to a dog's program: acupuncture, possibly chiropractic, a sissy loop, PEMF mats, things like that. So I think there are a lot of things that we could do that aren't going to cause harm, and may make these pets, pets, feel better.
Non-pharmaceutical interventions are really helpful, especially when you're dealing with multiple chronic health conditions.
Right. So I'm going to go completely off the rail here in another direction, ladies, because
thanks for the warning.
Yeah. So, because, I'm always interested in the emotional lives of animals. And so I almost ask this question every time, we have a podcast, but honestly, it's one of the biggest questions I get as a veterinary technician with animals that are in the end stage of their lives or receiving palliative care. And I'm not sure I can usually answer it, but I do my best. When people ask me, do I think that their pet understands that we're trying to help them? Do you have any thoughts on that, Dr. Schoenberg?
I think it depends on the pet. Honestly, and on the situation, I think that most of them do, at least on some level. Sometimes, and the reason I put caveats on is that I deal with a lot of pets with late stage dementia.
Yeah.
And for them, I think, unfortunately, it's hard for them to understand what's going on. And that's part of the tragedy of their diagnosis.
Right.
But for a lot of pets with chronic illness, especially when we're able to help support them in the home and help to find ways to support their agency. And I know that sounds a little cutesy, but I'll get into that in a minute, that they do come to understand that we're trying to help them. And when I talk about agency, what I mean there is patient consent and patient buy-in. And people say, oh, you can't have that in veterinary medicine. You can't ask an animal's permission.
You can.
Kristen, I do we are believers.
We do it all the time. Yeah,
absolutely. And one of the biggest lessons I learned in hospice was about patient consent and what that looks like, whether it is saying, you know, this cat absolutely hates taking oral medications. I say, okay, he does not consent to that. Let's find a way around. Can we get this made up as a transdermal medication? Can we decide that it's more traumatic to him to give him this than it would be to not? Or conversely, you know, this animal hates needles or doesn't want to go into the doctor's office anymore. How can we adjust their care plan to match their wishes for themselves? And when you do that, I do think they understand and they appreciate, yes, thank you for listening to me and understanding that I don't want to eat that. I would prefer soft food. I would prefer to get my medication through this other route.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're always communicating, but we don't always listen. We don't know how to listen. Right.
And that's one of the biggest things I always tell people when people say, oh, they don't show their pain or, oh, they don't tell us. They do. They're just speaking a different language.
Yep. And Kathy, are you done with your certification in fear-free?
Yes, I am certified fear-free practitioner.
Right. Congrats.
Thank you. It was a fantastic program. It's actually open to just about everyone. It's open to vets, veterinary technicians, other animal professionals, and there's courses for owners. And they break it down. I'm going to take the avian class too, because I see a lot of birds. So I'm going to take the certified fear-free for birds as well.
And we're interviewing the leader of that coming up soon, right?
Yeah. We are. Yeah.
Yeah.
Next week, I think.
Oh, that's excellent.
So you alluded earlier, you know, inevitably the time comes. And, you know, can you explain how, you know, your practice helps both the pet and the pet parent at the end of life and making that decision to know, you know, because that's one of the biggest questions I get is how do I know when it's time? And I'm sure having somebody like you in their court and, you know, kind of counseling them throughout the process, you know, again, if they reach out early, and Kathy and I will both do a better job of recommending this, you know, to our clients and things, but, you know, tell us a little bit more about how you help them to reach that decision and what that looks like.
Yeah. It's a question that I get at pretty much every visit is how do I know when it's time? And it's hard because the answer is it's different for every, not just for every person, but for every person and every pet. Even if they've been through this path before with another animal, it's going to be different each time because the path of the disease is different. Their ability to intervene and support the pet is going to be different. So the best thing I can do is give people the tools to know when their pet is suffering, when their pet is struggling, and to help them determine what their priorities are. There are a lot of different quality of life scales out there. I don't have a favorite because different people process things differently. So I like to give my families a bunch of different scales. Some are visual, some ask questions for them to answer, some are numeric, because we all have different ways of thinking and framing. But the most important things I always tell them to think about are the good days outnumbering the bad days? And more importantly, are the good days actually good or are they just less bad than the bad days?
Mm-hmm. Good point.
And there are a lot of ways to think about that and to track that. Sometimes I'll tell people, you know, take a picture of them every couple of days and then go back and look at the pictures. That can help you see changes that you may not notice looking at them every day. If there's more than one person involved, make sure you're talking and communicating. Make sure that you're all on the same page. And not to harp on it, but that's a place where a grief counselor or a therapist can really help in finding family consensus.
I find that recommending journaling to clients is helpful for not only them, but also for me about what their day looks like. Did they get up? Did they eat breakfast? Did they go outside? Did they have a bowel movement? Did they interact with you? And because I think when you're having a bad day, it may be difficult to like look back and go, oh, I had a good day, but it was, you know, it was 2 days ago. It's hard to see that good day because you're having a bad day. But also it helps me with trends. You know, this dog doesn't eat at night, or she's up at night crying, or, you know, so it helps me to see and bring to the veterinarian's attention, hey, look, we have some trends here where the dog doesn't eat in the morning or the dog doesn't sleep at night. So journaling for me seems to be a very helpful tool.
Absolutely. And trends, just like you said, I always try to tell people trends are more important than individual data points,
right?
Whether it's they have heart disease and we're watching their respiratory rate, or we're tracking their weight, or we're tracking their behavior. So yeah, journaling is an excellent tool. Or I also tell people if they don't have the time and energy for that, if they have like a Google calendar, just like color in the day at the end of the day, green for a good day, yellow for so-so, red for bad.
Yeah. Something quick. Yeah.
Yep.
But and I'll tell people, they can go back and look at the spectrum.
Yeah. And I'll tell people too, like just even on a printed calendar, you know, give it a number, you know, 1 through 5, you know, it can be really simple, you know, 5's a great day and 1 is a really poor day. And then you have just a few numbers in between, you know, it doesn't have to be 1 to 100, you know, it can be simplified. You know, sometimes too, I think that people, you hear more and more about this, I guess, as we're getting more feeds from social media and such about like bucket lists and people, you know, quitting their job and taking their dog on a, you know, trip around the country and that sort of thing. And in fact, my very good friend from physical therapy school, I recently communicated with, and her cat, Georgie, was put down just yesterday. And oh, wow. She put out there on Facebook, she's like, I need help coming up with my bucket list for a cat, you know, for Georgie. But I know that Georgie got some roasted chicken and she got to spend a lot more time on the furniture than she had previously, as the days were approaching. But, you know, how do you go on to facilitate, you know, the graceful exit from this realm? You know, do you encourage folks to, you know, create a great last day? You know, do you provide counseling on and discuss like who should be present? Do you encourage other animals to be present that may live in that household when it's time to euthanize? You know, do you discuss where the best place to do it may be? And are you open to, you know, different options and suggestions? Let's just talk about that whole last day, end of life kind of thing.
Absolutely. So bucket lists are definitely a thing, and they're as much about the people as the pets. What I counsel will depend on also what that pet's end looks like. Some people have the luxury of time and planning. Some people don't. So if they do have the luxury of time and planning, I tell them to think about kind of what kind of last memories they want to make and what that may look like, whether it's a puppuccino, or I had a family last week who took their dog to recreate her puppy photos, the first pictures they took when they first brought her home. I've been asked by a client to write a prescription for belly rubs, unlimited with infinite refills. And sometimes it is just a matter of thinking about who they want to be present. And the last couple of years has changed that. I've done a lot more Zoom euthanasias, and it sounds morose, but it is a chance for people to be there. And even I think when may this all be over someday, it'll be a chance for people who are physically distant to still be present. I tell them to think about how they want that visit to play out. And as for where in the house, I am luckily still a spry thing, and I am flexible to wherever the pet wants to be. Sometimes the pet will decide, well, big dogs will lie down in the middle of the hallway, and that is where it's going to happen.
Right.
But the beauty of it being at home is if you want it to be on your bed, on the sofa, on the back porch, I can work with that. And conversely, there are some people who do not want a home passing, and that's okay too. There are people who say, I don't want this to happen at my home because I don't want to forever look at my living room sofa and think that's where Misty died.
Right.
And so there is absolutely still a place for in-clinic euthanasia as well. But I tell them to think, you know, do you want to have music playing? If so, what songs? Do you want to write a letter and read it to them, or have some poetry or some words that you want to read? And as for other pets, we were talking earlier about the emotional awareness and the intelligence of animals. And it's been my experience that other pets in the house know what's going on.
Yeah.
Usually before the people do. They're going to be aware of the fact that their buddy is getting ready and is getting close to passing. So I admit my guidance with that is usually to choose the path that's going to make the humans present feel most comfortable. If having the other pets in the room is going to be a source of comfort, then I absolutely welcome them. If having the other pets present is going to be a distraction, then it's okay to have them in another place. And it's not going to stress or traumatize them to not be present. I also say they can invite them to come in after everything is said and done.
Mm-hmm. Right. I've heard, you know, some people take great solace in their dog coming over and being allowed to sniff the body, mm-hmm. you know, after they've passed. And, you know, you bring up like, well, you know, we're still certainly doing a vast number of euthanasias in clinic, and the other pet isn't present necessarily, right? So I like what you said about that they know what is going on long before we do. So they don't necessarily, we don't have to tell them, we don't have to make it so overt. It's like they get it. We need to give our animal friends that emotional awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, you brought up Zoom. I hadn't thought about that, but I know a lot of people who do schedule, you know, like you said, if you have the luxury time and you can schedule the euthanasia, you know, kids coming home from college, you know, mm-hmm. because they grew up with this pet, you know, was there for 15 years of their lives, and, you know, spouses coming home from a business trip or, you know, something like that. So, you know, it's nice to have so many options these days.
Yeah.
And out here, you know, we're pretty close to the water, to the Atlantic. And I know a lot of people will, you know, talk about that last day, you know, they may go through McDonald's drive through, get a cheeseburger, even though they know that the cheeseburger has historically upset that dog's stomach, you know, it's like, they love it so much. Or, yep. And then, you know, maybe they haven't been able to run on the beach for, you know, a long time, but they'll take them, you know, carry them down by the water and sit with them. And, you know, so there are just so many options, you know, when people really, really think about it. And like mm-hmm. you said so beautifully, kind of creating those last memories, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely. Although I will say the one piece of advice that I do always give families, and this is going to be a little bit of unfortunate practicalness in what's otherwise an emotional and beautiful and tragic time, is that if you're thinking of giving a pet that wonderful, rich, forbidden last meal, do it the morning of the appointment, not the night before, because nothing ruins your last beautiful 24 hours like sitting up with them, taking care of the upset tummy that comes after they eat the cheeseburger or the cheesecake or the...
Great point.
Yeah. So do it that morning. Yeah. Schedule the visit, and that morning take them out and get them an Egg McMuffin or a yep. whole donut box of chocolates.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that way you don't have to deal with the consequences.
Yeah. Well, this was fantastic and very enlightening, Dr. Schoenberg. I'm so glad that we had this conversation. And as we're kind of wrapping up here, I'm wondering, do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to leave the audience with?
Well, you already touched on my absolute favorite reminder, which is that age is not a disease. So I'll just expand on that and say that caring for our pets as they age can be such an opportunity for grace. These beings have given us so much love and joy, and I feel like there's a lot of beauty to be found in repaying that to them by cherishing them in their older years and in their final months and years. Mm-hmm. So celebrate your older pets, celebrate your ailing pets, and find the joy in that relationship.
I'd like to just read a little bit I found your website very easy to navigate, very clear about your mission and services you offer and so forth. And on the homepage, the very front page, this is what it says. And I thought it just captured everything. Our goal is to provide for the physical and psychological well-being of pets with geriatric, chronic, or terminal conditions and the emotional needs of the people who love and care for them. We aim to provide the best quality of life for as long as we can. And when that is no longer possible, provide a peaceful, pain-free passing with grace and dignity. And I do think, you know, that allowing them, you know, to pass, you know, via euthanasia is just our last gift, you know, that we can give if we are so fortunate to be able to do that. So just one final question, Dr. Schoenberg, is in your introduction, I mentioned that you have, according to your bio online, a cranky ball python. So please do tell, how did you acquire such a pet and how do you know he's cranky?
So when I first went to vet school, before I found the pet law hotline, my initial goal was to work with reptiles and exotics. Mm. And when I graduated, I was still doing a lot of work with that. And I wound up rescuing over time a couple of ball pythons. They are still my favorite herps. And Oberon is, I know he's cranky when he bites me. He's not the smartest. He's not the friendliest, but he is the handsomest, and I absolutely adore him. And he tolerates me.
I'm just over here grinning ear to ear.
He gets by on his good looks. Yeah,
he gets by on his good looks and the occasional moments of attention he will provide when he deigns to be worn as a fashion accessory.
Wow. Well, thank you for that, Dr. Schoenberg. Yes. It gives me quite an image. As we're closing up here, Dr. Schoenberg, can you tell our audience where they can find you?
Absolutely. So I do have a website. It's autumnvet.com. So A-U-T, U, M as in Mary, N as in Nancy, V as in Victor, E-T.com. I didn't think through how many possible ways there would be to misspell that when I picked the name. Or they can email me, which is autumnvet@gmail.com. And I'm always happy to talk about animal hospice. It is a real passion of mine.
Well, that rang through loud and clear. And once again, I just want to reiterate that I find the name of your practice just beautiful, because it implies, you know, the waning years, the autumn of one's life, but you're not yet into winter and there are things that can be done, but it emphasizes the care and then the facilitation of the crossing into another realm.
Yeah.
So
beautiful.
I think it's well thought out. So kudos.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. And thank you. We will bid you adieu and hopefully talk again soon. Before we close our show today, I would like to once again thank our wonderful sponsors at Heads Up Pets Water Collars and A Dog's Best Life Box.
Yes. And remember, when you're going to place your order on either website, you're going to want to use the promo code PETPOD22. That's PETPOD22 for your discount on ordering.
All this information is included in our show notes as well.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed our show. Follow us on Facebook or on Instagram at Petability Podcast.
For more information about Kathy's books and living with blind dogs, please go to enableyourpet.com. Thank you, and please tune in next time.